Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting with Sarah McDewling. We're sitting across from Jill Stark, who's coming to talk about Happy Never After, while why the happiness fairy tale is driving us mad and how I flip the script.
Welcome, Jill. Great title.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this is your second memoir.
It is, yeah.
So, generally, you know, there's lessons to be had from getting through that first memoir. And everything was meant to be absolutely perfect from that moment on. That was the goal, wasn't it?
Yes. So the High Sobriety was published, and that was a dream come true for me to have my first book published. And you know, I had it all. I had this very successful book. I had my career was flying as a journalist at the age. I bought my own home. I was dating a footballer. Everything had come together, and. And then, like, it's sort of slowly things started to unravel. And, I had a quite serious sort of breakdown. I suffered from anxiety and depression since I was a teenager, but this was epic. And I really started to – I couldn't figure out why I had reached my life's peak, but everything had kind of fallen apart. And, yeah, the more that I examined what had happened, I realized that a lot of the things that we think are going to make us happy in life aren't necessarily the things that – will bring us the contentment we've been told, you know, in this sort of fairy tale ending that we expect. It's often when those things happen that you realize that there's maybe something underneath that you need to look at.
You would never experience it, have you, Sarah? Just experience
aiming
for things, and when it actually comes true, it actually doesn't change your life and make everything perfect. No, we're both very much glass half full. No, we're lying. Help us.
Yeah, I need help. Well, look, I think the hardest part is sometimes trying to decipher what you think you want versus what will actually make you happy, right?
Yeah.
What are your tricks for doing that? Like, is it just about knowing yourself or?
I think, yeah, I mean, certainly after everything that I've gone through, I've probably known myself more than I ever have, and that's a lot of what I explore in this book. And I think we're so focused as a Western culture on often material things or the things that we're told will bring us success. So buying the home, finding the partner, you know, getting the dream job, buying more things. And that's the way that our culture is kind of set up. But really when you achieve all that and you strip that away, you realize that that's not actually what brings me meaning and purpose in life. And so I think, yeah, often you find yourself sort of scrambling around to find what really does lie beneath that discontent. And what I found was that so many people, when I told them what I was experiencing, were experiencing very similar things. I think we live in a culture that is absolutely frenzied by the sort of mass consumerism and this need to constantly be on the treadmill heading towards this destination, this happy ever after. And really, you know, we sort of live in a quite spiritually malnourished kind of time where we're very connected in the sense of being on social media, everyone's always on. But when you strip that away, we're actually quite disconnected from each other and from ourselves. So we've never had more ways to connect, but often people are feeling quite lonely and quite lost. And I think that's what I found, is that all of the life successes that I had reached they just left me feeling quite empty. And I'm acutely aware that as, you know, sort of quite a privileged person living in a developed country, that, you know, all those things that we think will make us happy, most other people don't always have access to that. But it's really, yeah, this kind of sense of, I think I describe it in the book as an existential bereavement, where we're really scrambling around looking for meaning, and it doesn't come in the places we think it will come from.
Do you have any map?
Yeah, like, how did you flip the script? I suppose it takes a book to answer that question, but like,
yeah, I mean, I think it's a lifelong thing as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the happiness trap, is that we're told that there's a quick fix to everything, and there really isn't. And I think a lot of it comes from accepting that happiness is actually not our default position as human beings, but we're told that we should be happy all the time. And kids are taught, we've got a self-esteem movement where kids are taught that everyone is special and you get a medal just for turning up, and sort of life's failures and disappointments are airbrushed out of the picture. And I think that's a real problem. So we, basically this book is kind of me figuring out what Eastern traditions have known for many centuries, is that our suffering comes from trying to push away our discomfort and from trying to run from any sense of sadness or anger or all those messy feelings that we don't like to feel. When you actually find a way to accommodate them and realize that that's normal, but that's not the culture that we live in. We live in a culture where people drink to excess or eat too much, or, you know, we're constantly addicted to our phones. And what are we doing with that? I think there's a lot of that is trying to get away from our sense of discomfort. So yeah, there's many things that I road test in this book, whether it's like trying to be more compassionate to yourself and to others, whether it's incorporating the art of play into everyday life, which we kind of abandoned when we become adults, but as children we're very good at. There's a number of things that you can do that I think that will ease that sense of discomfort, but there is no quick fix and there is no fast route to happiness. And I actually, after going through what I've gone through, I don't wish for that anymore. I kind of accept the messy feelings because they're part of being human.
I'm getting the sensation that my teenage self was right and Robert Smith was a god and that being an emo or a goth is the only path.
Yes.
I would love it. It'd be great. I've been lying on the floor listening to Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me a million times in a row.
Well, I don't think
it's not about being unhappy. Sorry to cut you off.
I don't think it's necessarily you need to be miserable all the time, but I think it's accepting that is part
okay.
of
and
life.
That's okay.
And that's okay.
Not be happy.
And in the book, I sort of go to some schools who are really embracing the idea of emotional intelligence teaching in schools, which I think is a lot better than either the teach to the test kind of paradigm we have, or the teaching of the self-esteem juggernaut, where you basically teach kids that they're unbreakable miracles, you know. And then whenever something goes wrong in life, they just don't know how to cope with it. Like, a lot of schools are now teaching kids the difference between, say, anger and being assertive, or
between... Cough, Sarah, just go ahead. There you go.
Sorry, I thought I was going to make it through. Sorry, everyone.
So, yeah, I think... a lot of people are starting to realize that what we've been doing is not working. And if you go through life expecting to be happy all the time, you're going to be disappointed. And so often, I mean, what happened to me happens to many people who reach success. If you look at Olympic athletes, people who become famous, that doesn't necessarily bring them great happiness. And in fact, for a lot of people, once they're in the public eye, or once they've reached that life pinnacle, it can feel quite lonely and quite empty. I think it's that part of our culture where we're taught to plan for the wedding and not the marriage, you know, or we plan for the birth and not the baby, or we plan for buying the home but not servicing the mortgage. And like, that's kind of the way it's set up. And it's sort of about, it's a cliche, but it's about the journey, not the destination. And I think that's what I've discovered.
That's really, I really like, that's very insightful. Sometimes it feels like that we're driven by desire, and so if you pour your whole self into reaching one goal and then you get it, what fuels you after that?
Well, that's exactly right. And I spoke to a friend before my first book came out, and she said to me, she'd recently finished a PhD, and she said it'd taken her years and she felt so accomplished at the end of it, but she also felt quite empty and quite lost. And she warned me, when your book comes out, just be aware this isn't going to be a magic pill for all your woes and you'll be happy ever after. And I was like, oh, don't be ridiculous. I got this. Like, my book is selling really well and it's a success. And I just was so excited that I would live this dream to write this book. And she was absolutely right, because all of my sense of self-belief and self-worth and was all tied to this external vision of myself. I talk about it in the book as being like looking at myself in a carnival hall of mirrors where everything was quite distorted. And I realized that underneath it all, there was this little voice saying, you're not enough. And so no matter of like reviews or accolades or best-selling books were going to make that part of me whole. And so that's the journey that I embarked on, is to really get underneath that. And if you look at it from a wider cultural perspective, our entire consumerist Western culture is based on that premise that we are not enough. But if you buy this car or if you have enough Facebook friends, then you might just be enough. But really, we're the only ones that can then fill that gap.
Yeah. Was there any sense in that leading up to publication and then that publication, this is going to get me free? Like, is there anything to, because I have this feeling, because I have a book coming out, and I have this feeling that if I just get over that hurdle, everything will be free.
Well, that's right. I mean,
you're smashing my dreams right now, but anyway.
You think that's going to be everything, and like, we have this fairy tale notion sold to us from a very early age, whether it's through the books that we read or through Hollywood, that, you know, you get to this point and that will be the end of it. And anyone who's gone through any difficult experience will know that actually it's the adversity that you face in life that often teaches you the most, and that you end up in hindsight thinking, oh, that was actually a rewarding experience. They've done studies on brides, and 50% of brides go through like postnuptial blues, where they've planned for this wedding for so long, and then at the end of it, I mean, it's over in a day, and then they're like, oh, everything's still the same. And I think that for me, everything was still the same, and there was never enough kind of external validation to make me whole. And I think if you look for that external validation, and we see that very much through social media, that's where things can start to go awry. And for me, particularly with social media, when I was quite unwell, I had to take myself off all of those platforms because there's this false notion that everyone is sort of living their bliss and, you know, hashtag feeling blessed, and everyone belongs and everyone is living the best life, when I knew that was nonsense, because I'd curated my own pictures on Instagram even when I was very unwell, when I was pretending that everything was fine. So it's sort of like we're all in a sort of Truman-style show version of our lives, and everyone knows that the plot is flimsy and the set is paper thin. It could like blow over in a light breeze, but we're all kind of playing along because we don't want to break that kind of fairy tale spell.
That's so true, because no one posts on Instagram when they're just sitting on the couch eating pickles. Like,
no, and I've started to do that more because like in a run-up to this book, obviously it's an exciting time and there's lots of publicity, and I'm doing like things like this podcast, for example. And just last week my toilet broke in my apartment, so I was like, I'm just going to Instagram that instead. So I did a little Instagram video of the plumber ripping the toilet out of my apartment, and was like, yep, totes glam, author life here, you know, like, I think we need to see more of that. And there are people that are starting to do that. We need to see more of real life, particularly for our young people who often really struggle with social media and that kind of crushing social comparison that they face.
Yeah, I mean, Instagram's the new Vogue magazine, isn't it? Like,
it is. I mean,
Vogue in the 80s, and you went, oh, my life is hopeless.
It's been, well, there was one of the psychological associations, I think it's the UK Psychological Association, it's been voted Instagram as the worst platform for mental health for young people, and that's largely as a result of body image, but also the idea that it's so curated and it's so stylized and everything is perfect, and it's really just feeds into that happiness fairy tale kind of illusion that we're all kind of chasing towards something that's not really real.
So how do we tear down the structure of society and make us all happy? Because I'm ready to go with you to the barricades. What are we going to take
you
first?
You have my support. Yeah.
Like, what do we do? Like, it's a consumer society. We're in it. Every turn.
Instagram?
It's just,
I think, it's a tricky one. For me, like, I've done some basic things, like, you know, the Marie Kondo's decluttering book, which I took to with great aplomb, and I might strip back all the stuff in my apartment and try to...
Wait, that doesn't include books, does it?
No, of course. Well, actually, no, I did get rid of a few of my books. I had Shane Crawford's autobiography, you know, the Hawthorne player, ex-player. I was like, that needs to go, so that went. But, so I sort of stripped things back, but also just realizing that it's not stuff that's going to make you happy anyway. I interviewed a friend of a friend who won in a home lottery. She won a $1.4 million home. For her and her husband and two kids. And, you know, she moved into that home and it was a dream come true. And then she turned right, like everything, you know, everything came at exactly the right time. And she turned to her husband one night and said, why is there no joy in our life? And she realized that you take away, obviously they were now financially comfortable, and that's a considerable burden to be taken off a couple, but they still were just on this treadmill of duty and responsibility, and they didn't really have any meaning to their lives. So they had to sort of rethink that. And I think, yeah, that's one of the things I think you need to do is not think that money is going to make you happy. Like, the research shows that, yes, a certain level of money will give you the basics that are kind of the pillars of happiness, whether it's just security, having a warm place to sleep at night, having enough to be able to feed you and your family. But after it's $75,000, the research shows that there is no material difference to your happiness after that point. So there's no material improvement after that point. So it's why you see people like Twiggy Forrest, the mining magnate, giving away vast amounts of his fortune. I think, oh, that's a great thing, he's doing it. But he's also doing it because it feels good.
Mm.
Because once you get to that point and you own everything and you've got your own yacht and your own island or whatever, like, and you're still going, I'm not quite, there's something missing, then you realize that these things aren't what make us happy.
That that Socrates line that everyone quotes, unexamined life is not worth living. And my way to happiness, and it's a very medium level of happiness, it's not excitement, jumping around, never do that, is just learning stuff.
Mm.
Like, that's been my default mode. When I know that I'm shit, I'm feeling shit, I return to the books and I will read on history or take on something that's a challenge, like a philosophy book that I'm never going to finish, and tackle that, or read lit that looks terrifying from the outside, like an old classic, but when you're actually involved, you're just completely in love. Those kind of things are the things I turn to. What are the things that you're turning to now and to kind of give you...
I find one of the things that I think runs through a lot of this book, but also a lot of Eastern philosophy, is compassion, and compassion for yourself and for others. So it's still a work in progress for me. Everything is, and it will be till the day I die. But I think a lot of the problems that we see in our current world come from that lack of connection to others.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to live in a much more open way than I used to, not as closed off. So if someone is in a bad mood, I, you know, automatically used to presume that I'd done something wrong, or I would judge them. Whereas then I try to see, like, what's going on for that person, because there's so often like these invisible struggles that we can't see. And compassion in everyday life, it's why we see people just on Twitter just yelling at each other, and it's just these warring tribes. Why is Trump in the White House? Let's have a think about what is driving the people to vote for him rather than just say they're all redneck morons. I mean, it's not a coincidence that Hillary Clinton calling Trump supporters a basket full of deplorables quite possibly helped build his coalition. You know, we need to sort of reach out to each other. And I think that when you do that, it does improve your sense of well-being, your sense of the world not being such a shit place, if you look around and actually try to see the good in people. And I know that's not always easy when people can be quite hateful, but I don't think that piling more hate onto hate is ever the solution. So I used to be a very, very angry, mouthy Twitter. I wouldn't say I was a troll, but I was, you know, in my little lefty corner fighting the good cause. And I still am very passionate about the causes that people on the conservative side of politics might call, you know, social justice warrior, or, you know, that kind of the worthy causes. But I try to have a lot less fury in my life, and I don't have as much anger as I used to. And I think that's really important, because when you start to dehumanize the people who you disagree with by calling them a moron or a redneck or, you know, whatever it might be, it's easier to dismiss them and to not listen to them and to sort of other them, if you like. And I think the more that we do that in our world, the more divided we get. So I try to do that. I also, I live with a lot more play in my life. So I've looked at this book a lot, at the research around play, which, you know, when we're kids, we sit in the sandbox and we play for no reason. We play games. And then when we get to adulthood, we're told that that is frivolous and we shouldn't do that. But there's the leading researchers in play have shown that play is actually part of our primal makeup, and it actually helps us to thrive as humans. So if you can schedule in time, and that might be, for me, it's things like I dance a lot in my apartment with my cat, or sing when I'm running. If I hear a song and it really takes me and I want to sing, I'm like, oh no, there's people around. I don't care anymore. Yeah. People think I'm mad. I've been mad. I've gone mad. I've come back again. I might be mad again. I don't care. Like, embrace that play nature, because when you do, you're really connecting with a part of yourself that I think a lot of us have lost. So scheduling in time for yourself, taking yourself on dates, not being afraid to go to dinner alone, you know, those kind of things that really help you get connected to yourself so that you can also, in turn, be more open to being connected to others.
Mm. And does that tie in with, because one of the things that keeps coming up in these interviews is smartphones and pockets in handbags. Do you give yourself time to have that around?
And then I mean, for me, so anyone who's read my first book will know that that obviously it would appear that I have quite an addictive nature. And I think that when I spoke to Dr. Larry Rosen, who is the world's leading expert on what he calls eye disorders, and I as in the letter I, so as an iPhone. And he described the way that we are becoming habituated to our phones. So it's exactly the same chemical that's released when we drink. So it's like dopamine rush when we get that Facebook like, which makes us want to go back for more. And then over time, we need more of that to get the same effect. So for me, I can find myself in these compulsive social media checking all the time. So I have to actually give myself limits. So I've started only allowing myself to look at my social media at certain points of the day for 15 minutes at a time. And it's like, I have to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think, God, this is pathological. But so many people are having exactly the same issues. Yeah. And as I looked at in this book, it's not just a coincidence. The people behind these apps are developing them in a way to specifically trigger those neurological pathways so that, you know, people who are developing these apps have worked out exactly how an individual user behaves, and they will then issue, so whether it's, you know, sometimes on Instagram you'll suddenly get like a whole flush of likes all at once on one of your posts. That's being done deliberately to get you to go back to that app. You see it with things like streaks with Snapchat, where, you know, kids are absolutely obsessed with not losing their streak, and that means they have to send a picture back and forth to the same person every day, and if they lose their streak, it's the end of the world. So it's, yes, we have to have self-control, but we're also living in an environment where people are designing the technology around us to keep us sort of hooked in like guinea pigs. So, yeah, I try to limit my time on social media, but it's not easy. I think I got rid of Snapchat a couple of years ago, actually, just doing my head in. And then I was like, I can't deal with Snapchat and all its stories, you know, function. Yeah. Now Instagram's got stories, and I'm just like, oh, it's ruined Instagram for me.
We can't escape. And it is like a drug because it's a source of validation. Mm. And so if you're having an average time, or even if you're having a good day,
And it's not just a validation. I think it's very much like the way that we used to live, you know, when in caveman days, being part of a tribe was absolutely essential to survival. If you weren't part of a group, you could, you know, die of hypothermia. If you weren't in the group, you could starve if you didn't have enough food. You could get eaten by wild cats. Now when we have, you know, less risk of being eaten by a tiger, and we live in, you know, climate-controlled apartments, and, you know, food is conveniently available, we now, that sense, that need to be part of a tribe you know, the actual fundamentals of life are taken care of for most of us, luckily. But that sense of needing to be part of a tribe is still very much a primal driver. And I think that is much of what is behind our need to be part of something on social media. So in this current day, Facebook likes are our tribe in some ways.
It's just that need has become emotional and mental more than actually like physical.
You're not going to die if we don't get Facebook likes, but our ancient brains think that we will.
Yeah.
Jill, thank you so much for coming in and talking about
it's been really interesting.
Man, and we both are ready. If you want to go to the barricades, we're there.
Right. Yes, okay. Come with me.
We've got your back.
We're smashing smartphones as we rush to them.
Excellent.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And you can get hold of Jill's book on booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.